it's the wind blowing in the rain, tide just rolling in and make it flood again.
Welcome to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 97 FM. I'm your host this week, Avi Marr.
I don't know why I hear you crying out loud.
Willie Vlotten is an American author, musician, and songwriter. He was the lead singer of the Portland rock band Richmond Fontaine. He is songwriter and current member of the D-Lines. Born and raised in Reno, Nevada, he is the author of 7 novels: The Motel Life, Northline, Lean on Pete, The Free, Don't Skip Out on Me, The Night Always Comes, and his latest, The Horse, coming out this month. Willie has received the Silver Pen Award from the University of Nevada and was inducted into the Nevada Writers Hall of Fame. He has also received the Ken Kesey Award for Fiction and was a finalist for a Penn Faulkner Award. The Motel Life, Lean on Pete, and The Night Always Comes have all been adapted into films. Willie has been called the literary equivalent of Shane McGowan and Tom Waits, and the Irish Times calls The Horse Willie Vlotten's most satisfying book to date. Welcome back to Between the Covers, Willie Vlotten.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to help your Portland KBOO fans catch up on all your successes. So I wanted to say congrats on The Night Always Comes. Is it going to be a film or a series, or what's going on?
It's going to be a Netflix movie, and I think they're finishing filming this week. So, yeah, it's pretty exciting. I mean, it's pretty wild. I haven't had a whole lot to do with it, but it's exciting nonetheless. You sign it to the person that's interested that you think's the best, and then you pray to God they're smarter than you and that they're going to make something beautiful. Whether they do or not, I don't know. I mean, they've been nice. You know, it's good for Portland. Bring some money.
Filming it here, right?
Yeah. So pushes some money into the city. And so, you know, fingers crossed they're good at what they're doing.
Do you have any interest in writing for movies or TV or anything? Because they tend to love your stuff and they've made movies out of it. But is it such a different beast?
Yeah, I mean, it is a different beast. I wrote a screenplay for The Motel Life, my first novel. I got hired by this really brilliant guy. And he said, and he was a filmmaker, screenwriter. And he said, "Man, you and I'll go to Mexico City and I will teach you how to write screenplays. And we will write this together." And I said, "Holy hell, that's great!" You know, so I signed a deal with him. You know, I was nervous about it, but I was excited. I'd never been to Mexico City, and he was a cool dude. You know, that was really the last time we talked about it. I'm not that smart. I'm not that tough, and so I thought that was a good example of wasting your life writing for movies. I don't think I'm savvy enough or have the ambition to deal with a bunch of smart, ambitious people. So I kind of just backed off. You pay the price for backing off. You know, they might make decisions that you're not into, but I don't think I could get anything made or, and I don't want to spend my life chasing that. So, but I love movies. I mean, I love movies. So you just got to kind of know how tough you are. And I don't think I'm, you know, you got to be like a pretty brilliant car salesman to make it in that world. And I'm not.
So let's talk about your novel, the new one.
All right. The Horse. Yeah.
Oh, The Horse. Okay. Ready? Fangirl time.
I think it might be my new favorite. It is so gorgeous. Al, last time we were talking, you were working on this character. Can you talk a little bit about how this book took shape?
Yeah, you know, I was working on a book called Don't Skip Out on Me. And I was, this old friend and I were driving through central Nevada. We were kind of based out of Tonopah, and then we started camping all around central Nevada. I was just taking pictures, thinking about Don't Skip Out on Me, that book. And we came to this big kind of desert playa. We came across what looked like, you know, and we're 30 miles from, you know, the nearest paved road, and maybe 10, 15 miles from the nearest ranch. And we came across what looked like, you know, a statue of Black Horse. And so we pull over and we walk out to get closer to it, to find it's a wild horse, and it's completely blind in the middle of this desert playa. I don't think I'd ever seen anything quite as sad. For whatever reason, it really knocked me down. The idea of, number one, a horse being blind is so frightening for a horse, because it's a flight animal. It's alone, and horses hate being alone. And there was no water or shade for miles, and, you know, it's the middle of summer. So it just stopped me and my buddy in our tracks, and you could see on the horse, there was all these, like an old man, there's just scars. There's just tons of scars, because the horse had lived a hard, long life. And anyway, so we camped near it that night. And then we drove back to Tonopah the next day and called the Bureau of Land Management, and they brought a guy out for the horse. And we kind of kept doing the same trip. And so we got farther out, and we came across this old mining claim. We found this old assayer's shack that was in pretty good shape. And I told my buddy, I was just like, man, I don't think I'm tough enough for living anymore around people. And, you know, I'd been touring too much. I was boozing too much. My life was kind of feeling sideways, you know. And so I told him I was going to, you know, just get out there. And he just doubled over laughing. I was all dramatic about it, you know. And like I get around my old buddy. And he said, oh, man, where are you going to plug your record player in, you know? And you're going to start crying about your wife. And if, like, a couple weeks, you'll be cool. You'll be like, oh, yeah, I'm all right. And then a couple weeks later, you'll be, you know, hitchhiking into town to call her to come get you. And, you know, he was right. And anyway, I went home and I started thinking about that. Like, when you get to that age, you start getting older and you're like, man, I just had enough. I've seen enough. I'm not that tough. I thought I'd get tougher. I thought my skin would get tougher, and it's not gotten tougher. So, and then I'd always wanted to write one about music. I thought about the life of a journeyman musician. And when I grew up as a kid, it was casino musicians. Like, that way of making a living as a musician was going out of style. And it was always seen as kind of a bad thing to be a casino musician anyway. But I always thought it was cool. And a couple of the guys I played with in high school, their dads were casino musicians. They were some of the last guys that, like, would have a job on a floor show or something. Like, they were really, once the corporations took over casinos in the 70s, the life of a big music scene in casinos disappeared, because they realized it didn't bring in any more money and it cost a lot of money. And so these guys, these old guys that were still working casinos, the dads, they took me aside and they said, man, never play casinos, because you just play other people's songs and people yell at you if you're too loud or if you get too crazy. There's like a red phone that lights up, and the phone says, like, calm down, you know, don't have too much fun. And they're talking to me about this, but they worked 3 hours a day, a night, and they had a showgirl girlfriends. And I was like, well, Jesus, man, you guys barely do anything. And I was raised that, you know, I was raised that you work from morning to night and you're miserable and you're supposed to be miserable. That's what work is. And I was like, man, I want to hang out with a woman that's 6'2" and, you know, and work 3 hours a day. So anyway, so that's where my interest in that. And I wanted to write about a journeyman because I don't know anything but that sort of life. So I was interested in that. And then I just wrote that the horse for myself. I didn't think I would publish it. I thought it was too weird and too dark maybe to publish. So I just kind of wrote it for myself. And then it started feeling like it could be something that I would want to publish. So that's my long-winded. Sorry.
It's fine. So Al goes back and forth from sweatpants to jeans and writes songs. That's his like daily life. And you said in the past that when you're deep into writing a book, you look a little rough too. Was that true at times? Were you like alone for days wrestling with this story and this kind of?
Well, it's different. You know, like if I'm writing, I think like if I'm writing songs, it's not so much the case anymore because I'm trying to be better. In the old days, if I was writing songs, I would look like I slept under a car because my life would probably be going. So I've always generally written songs when things are going south on me. So yeah, if you saw me, you know, walking down the street and you go, man, he looks bad. Then you go, oh, he's probably writing songs right now. And then if you see me jogging down the street, then you go, oh, he's trying to write because he's trying to get his little brain to like be better. And so when I'm writing, you know, I take care of myself just because I'm not that smart, man. And I gotta use everything I got. And so I have to take care of myself and I can't drink just so I have a clear head. So with this one, I mean, this one was like the, you know, in a way, it's my study of alcoholism too. It's my kind of like, it's my way of like analyzing my own battles with alcoholism and my own battles with being a musician in a way. So, but again, like all my novels, I clean up pretty good when I'm writing because I need all the help I can get.
So one of my favorite Portland writers, Margaret Malone, says one of the ways she thinks about a novel is that the main character in the novel has a question and the novel is them wrestling with the question. So like you were just talking about, like, what do you think Al's wrestling with out there in the cabin?
Well, I mean, I think when he's, you know, he lives till he's 60, just kind of being a journeyman musician in Las Vegas and in Reno. And I think he starts running out of reasons to keep getting up in the morning. And he inherits this old mining claim from his uncle. And like a person does, like sometimes you just have to move just so you have a different reason to get out of bed. So I think it was a mistake. When he moves out there, he knows it's a mistake. But he gets kind of lost in that quagmire that you do when you spend too much time by yourself. He starts thinking about his past too much. So to me, he's just lost in these kind of dark quagmires of his past, and he can't stop thinking about them. And so he's kind of lost in the mistakes he's made in his past. I think that's what he's you know, everybody wrestles with from the moment you're born to your last breath, you wrestle with stuff and the same old stuff that haunts you, or the same old stuff that you haven't been able to shake, or you thought you shook, or you shook for a few years or whatever. But Al, I think out when he's out in the mining claim, he's just lost in memories and he can't shake it. And that's a hard thing to be alone and unable to stop thinking about things you don't want to think about.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. If you're just tuning in, our guest today is Willie Vlotten, author of 7 novels, including his latest, the horse.
He's like an example, like as a character of somebody, like you say, a journeyman who kind of goes unnoticed in the background or is forgotten or passed over. And a lot of your characters are like that. Yeah. In your writing, they're not heroic. They're not anti-heroic, but there's so much humanity in them. We get to understand them in a way. Are those characters a choice you make, or is that just who shows up in your head?
Well, I mean, like in this novel, I guess one of the reasons I've never written about music is I've never liked novels about rock and roll.
Yeah.
They've always felt kind of fake and false or grandiose. Like they were, you know, and I just didn't relate to them at all. I mean, I love biographies about real musicians, but any novel I'd read about rock and roll, I never really liked. So I wanted to write about a journeyman because I don't know anything more than a journeyman. I've never been a rock star. I've been on a bus a couple times drinking beer with like a buddy of mine that hits it big for a while, but I've never, you know, gone to a gig on a bus. I've always been in a van. So I don't know anything about rock stars and I'm not interested. You know, one of the bad, among other truckloads of bad things about me is when I started playing music, I just loved songs. You know, I love songs so much and I love disappearing into tunes as a kid. You could put on a, you know, record by Tom Waits or the Pogues and suddenly you're in a different world. And the power of that, has always attracted me and it saved my life when I was 11. From 11 on, it became my favorite place to hide is inside songs. But I never once thought about being a rock star, you know, like that just didn't cross my mind. And so I got in a band just so I could be closer to the records, you know, so I could plant my flag with the musicians because I loved songs. But I never once thought about playing in front of people. I never thought like you're supposed to entertain people. I didn't think about anything. So I missed that whole memo on like entertaining and like, you know, like half the articles you ever read about old rock stars is all about getting ladies, you know, and I didn't care about any of that stuff. I just wanted to write tunes and hang out with dudes that like music. And so in that regard, Al and I are real similar in that. So when I decided to write a book about a musician, I, you know, that was the kind of musician I was going to write about, mainly because I don't know anything else. And secondly, I've never had interest in that. I never had interest in the rock star stuff. Now, I, you know, granted, I love seeing big flamboyant shows. And I mean, some guys just have it, but that was never an interest to me. Obviously, if you've ever seen me play, you know.
Well, then it must have been hard because you were the lead guy in Richmond Fontaine. I mean, that change from Richmond Fontaine to the D-Lines must have been such a relief for you then.
Yeah, when I first started, you know, I think I played my first gig in a bar at like 15, 16, something like that. And probably like 17, 18, I played more bars and, you know, I had to be just, you know, like pretty loaded just to get up on stage. I mean, I could barely go to high school. I was so shy. And so for me to be in front of people was horrific. Yeah. And I did it just because I wanted to be in a real band, you know. I mean, I basically sobbed the first time, my name was on a flyer, you know, on a telephone pole. It was like the greatest day of my life. You know, it was like Monday night at some like Max's bar, you know, and you're just the little name below the main name. I still have it, you know? So I bought into the stuff, but you know, I drank my way through it from probably honestly, probably like 18 to 35, pretty blind drunk every time I got up on stage. Because it's hard to gauge how drunk you are when you're really nervous. When your anxiety's high, you can drink a lot. And the big problem is you're about four songs in, your nervousness goes away because you're just being in a band again. And then all of a sudden the booze hits you. And then so you go,
then you're just drunk.
Then you're drunk. And then you got to figure out how to get through the rest of the gig in one piece. And then I remember with Richmond Fontaine, I was probably in my early 30s. This guy drove up from Reading to see us in Portland. And then he drove up from Reading and then he was going to drive back home right after the gig. And I used to do that from Reno. I used to go see shows in San Francisco in my mom's car and then drive back home. So I related to the kid a lot. And he really liked my band. And I was really drunk. And I was so ashamed of myself, you know, that this kid had driven all this way. And I was pretty drunk. So I told myself I had to figure it out or quit. And so then I would just drink a couple beers before I'd go on. And then I'd bring like three with me on stage in case my nerves went. And I've kind of figured it out after that. I've been all right with it ever since that. But yeah, it was a rough, whatever, 15 years of trying to be in a band and being, you know, so shy. I could, you know, I could barely walk down the street, but yet I'm in a singing in a band. Yeah. Yeah.
Was it hard to sing your own stuff versus other people's early on?
I just say my own. That was one of the things the casino guys told me. They just said, never play anybody else's songs. Just write your own. And because he goes, you'll just get sucked into it. They were really disillusioned. Both guys had near misses with bands and they were disillusioned. And so, yeah, I just wrote a lot of songs from when I was a little kid. I wrote a lot of tunes. So, yeah, we'd play other people's songs, sure. But I was always writing my own tunes.
Well, then I can see why it would make you so nervous. It's so putting yourself out there as just a super young person saying what you have to say.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I could barely go to a store when I was a kid. So, I mean, I was at a different level. I was a different level.
You're an A-plus shy person, huh?
Yeah, I had a difficult time. That's for sure. I mean, and in a way, you know, being in a band saved my life because it forced me. You know, if I didn't have that, I'd probably be just working in a warehouse somewhere, you know, by myself. It taught me how to get along and it taught me how to talk in front of people. So, I mean, it killed me. It nearly killed me, but it kind of saved my life too. So,
one specific thing I love about your writing is you have this kind of tenderness that you bring to people who are mostly silent in their life. And I felt like in The Horse, you really were able to do that about, I think it's what we're just talking about Al's drinking. Drinking helps him get through his life. Would you be okay to read a section about that?
Oh yeah, yeah. It was a month after Mona had left for Nashville that Al woke up one morning and felt, from the moment he opened his eyes, as though someone were trying to push him out of an airplane from 30,000 feet. He couldn't make sense of it. He was heartbroken over Mona, that was true. But he had started a full-time casino gig as the guitar player for the Ronnie Willis band. He was making good money. And he liked Ronnie Willis, and Ronnie liked his songs. As he lay in bed that morning, he was a bit hungover, but he wasn't sick. It wasn't booze. The night before, he'd played the gig, eaten a late-night dinner at the Nevada Club, and gone to bed. Nothing he'd done could explain waking up in complete terror and panic. In the shower, he looked his body over to see if there was something causing the pain. But nothing was different. He dressed and made coffee and realized he had felt the same way before. A month after Vern's death, he had woken in the middle of the night out of breath and crying. But that panic feeling of missing his uncle, it happened only a dozen times, each episode lasting under a half hour. It was like a nightmare that dissipated the longer he was awake. He'd had the feeling other times too, once when his mother and he were in a car, a semi-truck veered into their lane and almost hit them head on. For 10 minutes afterwards, he could barely breathe. Another time, when he and Vern were up near Verdi swimming in the truckie, he got a river shoe caught in a fallen tree at the bottom of a deep pool. He was certain he was going to drown, and he began to squirm and panic, but the shoe came off and he escaped. But in those times, his rattled nerves made sense, and the feeling vanished as quickly as it came. This time, it didn't. He told no one what was happening to him and asked no one for help. He was afraid if he told one doctor, then that doctor would tell another, and eventually he'd be put in the state mental ward. So instead, he medicated by drinking. Because when drunk, he wasn't being pushed out of an airplane at 30,000 feet. The plane and the falling and the panic and fear disappeared with each drink he had. So he stayed out all night and slept all day. And when afternoon came and he got up, the panic would get up too. And by the time he walked to the Cal Nevo or Miguel's Mexican restaurant to eat, it would be a part of him again. It would stay with him while he ate, while he walked home, while he drank coffee and played guitar in his kitchen, and while he performed his evening gig. After 6 months of it, he bought a pistol, a 357, and decided to kill himself. At least once a month, he put the stainless steel revolver on the kitchen table. He could pick it up, and he could put the barrel in his mouth, but he couldn't pull the trigger. In the paper was a help wanted ad for a breakfast cook at the Fitzgerald's Casino. He applied and got the job. He also kept his gig with Ronnie Willis. On gig nights, he wouldn't get to bed until 2 a.m. He left for Fitzgerald's at 5. When he got home from cooking, it was 2 in the afternoon, and he'd be so exhausted, he'd fall asleep until he had to get up for his evening gig. His hope was that the constant work would distract him, that it would derail the spiral he was in. He lost weight and got drunk 7 nights a week. He destroyed his life in hopes of saving it. The day he turned 23, he had a birthday dinner with his mother at her duplex. Afterward, on the way home to his apartment, he bought a 6-pack of Coors. He drank the beers in his kitchen while he worked on a song called "They're Fighting Again Next Door," about the couple who lived below him. It didn't seem like a big deal at the time, bringing home a 6-pack of beer. But in hindsight, he supposed it was. As a kid, he made a pact with his mother that he would never drink. And when he broke that pact, he made another with himself that he would never bring alcohol into his home. But that night, as he played guitar and drank beer in the safety of his kitchen, his loneliness and sadness over Mona, his failing mental state, and the uncertainty of his life as a musician disappeared. He worked on the song and drank and thought of nothing else. His apartment, which had become a sort of prison he struggled to get out of and hated to go into, became a haven.
Thank you so much. So, can we talk about the horse now?
Yeah.
So the horse arrives. So Al's in this, and I know you talked about the horse a little bit earlier, but it is similar to the horse that they run into in Lean on Pete. Yeah.
I mean, it's different to me. This is, it's a weird thing, because I did write Lean on Pete about a horse, and to me this is really the horse. To me, kind of represents that it's a basic idea, which is, you know, when you're drowning, the only way to save yourself from drowning is to save somebody else who's drowning. And I think that's what saves Al's life is this horse is this blind horse shows up outside his shack and won't move. And Al doesn't know anything about horses. He doesn't know what to do. He's neglected starting his car for 7 months. His buddy that checks up on him is out of town for a year. He has no phone. And he's you know, isolated himself intentionally. Maybe suicidally a bit. And then the horse, he realizes like the pain that this horse is going through and the hardship the horse is going through is bad enough that he has to get his life together enough so he can try to help this thing. So it is that basic, it's a pretty basic idea, which, you know, help somebody that's hurting worse than you, and it'll help pull you out of it as well.
Yeah.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. If you're just tuning in, our guest today is Willie Vlotten, author of 7 novels, including his latest, The Horse.
So one kind of nerdy question, because there's the storyline of like he's in the cabin and what's happening going forward, but we learn all about his life going back all the way. Just about how you write it. Do you write one part, the going forward part, and then each of these different threads, like when he's a kid and when he's a young adult and all that? Or does it just all come out of you?
No, you know, I edit. There's so much flashbacks. I was really interested in the idea of not being able to get out of your mind. And you see as if Al's feeling okay, his memories are okay. Once he starts drinking, his memories go really south on him. They go to particular things like you do. If you're really tired, your memories go somewhere. So I was interested in that. It was a lot of editing. You know, I edited the book for years, 3 years maybe straight. So I probably wrote twice as much for the book, probably an extra couple hundred pages. And then I would just pull stuff out and try and put stuff in and try to get the mixture right. So I think initially I probably tried to do what came across, which is go back and forth so much, but I did it pretty clumsily. And then, you know, the one thing I like about, or the thing I love about writing novels is it's not a performance. You just keep tinkering. And I love that aspect of it. So I just tinkered and, you know, went half mad a lot of the times and really struggled. This was a really hard book for me to write because it is complicated and it's tone and I think, and how it jumps around so much, you know? So yeah, I definitely struggled with it. So it was a lot of editing and pulling stuff out and putting stuff in.
Well, I guess it's where I never got confused about where I was. And that's always amazing to me. Like, cause you're popping around into all different times of his life. And then we're back in the present. And whenever I'm never confused, I want to ask the writer, how do you do that?
You just beat your head against the wall and just keep working on it and working on it. The most fun I had with it too was just like, if depending on his mood is, you know, was the memory you would have. And so I loved that aspect of it. Like when he starts drinking and his memories are all based in that, or when he's in love, his memories are all kind of based in that. That was really fun. And, you know, and the casino stuff was really fun, those memories to write about. Some of the harder stuff, like what I just read, really. Those are tougher, take longer. But, you know, again, you just keep tinkering on it until you get it right. Or you hope you get it right. Or you get it right at least for a bit. And then you wash your hands of it, you know.
he's completely honest with himself, it seems to me, in this moment. And it might be he's gotten to that place where he's looking at things and reviewing them. Is that a particular thing about this guy where?
I mean, I think he was always pretty savvy about himself. I mean, obviously he's a really damaged kid. He was a damaged guy.
Yeah.
And you can see it with throughout his life, you know, the way he was raised by his mother, you know, his first wife, he was barely 20 when he meets her, and she's 40. And she's an interesting, complex woman.
Yeah.
So I think he's always been around damaged people. And I think damaged people attract damaged people. And so throughout his life, he's surrounded by broken people. Now, some of that is, you know, you do in that line of work, being in art, you know, being a musician, you're going to be around people that are a little more ragged or have been beat up a little bit more, because not always, but oftentimes, because, you know, that's why music calls to them, because they're in some little bit of pain that's in some sort. So yeah, he's definitely surrounds himself with people that make sense to him, and all those people tend to be a little beat up. But yeah, I don't see him delusional at all. I mean, I guess the only guy you could maybe say that is delusional is Horace Hopper from Don't Skip Out on Me. But I don't think he was delusional as much as he was a kid in a ton of pain.
Yeah.
And he had the kid dream of that he could change his identity. That dream when you're a kid that you don't have to be you, that you can take whatever that kind of simmering emotional stuff that you're scared of, that you know is going to come and get you, meaning your past, your hard life or whatever, that you can escape it all. And I think in Horace's case, he literally thought he could change himself. That's why I love that kid so much. He's my favorite. But yeah, he's a little delusional, I guess, in that. But old Al, he's pretty savvy.
Maybe you're making a good point about Al's looking backwards, and so he can see everything. But I thought it was really, like, even to his mom, when his mom tried to blame his alcoholism on other stuff, and he just was like, no, it's me. I that was when I loved him. I just thought he was so honest about what was happening.
Yeah, I think he's one guy that's probably never really blamed anybody else for his situation. You meet people that blame other people for their situation, and then people that kind of just own it. They probably have a right to blame other people for their situation. But Al, I don't think he ever thought that way. I think Al was just never really, I think he was pretty much let down most of his life. And he just kind of hides out within booze and writing tunes. I think those are the things that he finds comfort in. And, you know, and it's interesting. I've had musicians read this book, and none of them think it's depressing or his life is bad, which is really funny. I've had people read it that go, oh, it's so bleak, like his life as a musician is bleak. And then the guys I know in bands are like, hey, man, he was in a couple of good bands, and he had a few ladies that liked it. Yeah, he got a few ladies that liked him. So we had, like, what else do you want in life, you know? And I always thought that. I always thought he was a pretty successful musician. And in the big scheme of things, I thought he was really successful. I thought he did really great.
Speaking of, there's lots of song titles that go throughout the book. And I loved it as a sort of, like, a summary of, well, how was that chapter? And then all the song titles, you know, it was like poetry, you know, this line and this line and this line. Did you write any tunes? Are any of those songs?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, over the years I've kind of whittled, you know, I mean, I think there's over 230 of them. So that's a lot. I think I've written a handful of them, maybe 20 over the years. To me, the song titles, I wanted the reader to kind of see where he's at that time in his life. also kind of who he's writing for. Mm-hmm. So like if he's writing for like the sisters, Lyndon Lacy, he writes a certain style. Or if he writes for the Sanchez brothers, he writes a certain style. Or for Mona Maverick, he writes another style. When he writes for himself, it's a different style. But my hope was that you would see where he was at in his life or what he was interested in by the titles. It was really, that part was fun. And the snippets of lyrics, you know, there's a few lyrics in there that you get to kind of see kind of what he's doing and what he's interested in. And so, yeah, that aspect was really fun. That was the most fun of the book. That and the writing about the casino stuff was really fun. The rest of it was more difficult.
How was writing songs sort of for him as him? That was fun?
Yeah. I mean, it's just a blast. I mean, the thing is, I never really think about these things when I'm working on it. But I mean, obviously, he's pretty similar to me. And so it was basically just songs that I was thinking about, or if I had to write for, you know, a crazy 40-year-old lounge singer when I was 20, what kind of songs would I write? Or, you know, if I got in a band, like a cowpunk band of two brothers, you know, what would I, if I wrote them songs? So it was that kind of stuff's just, you know, it's just fun. And I was interested in the idea of, you know, a musician changes, like guys, you know, growing up, they might be in a calypso band or a reggae band or a ska band or a metal band, depending on their talent, you know, if they can do any all that stuff. And they're just like a really good player can do all that stuff. Now me, I can't. I'm not very good that way. But like guys I play with, they can play, do anything. So I was interested now playing in all these different, you know, kind of, he just kind of rolls with it as he gets older, you know. He just plays whatever he can get, whatever kind of gigs he can get, he gets.
So what's his sound?
What's his sound?
Yeah, if he's just writing for him, because I know you've done this and I know you've written music for characters in other books of yours. So what kind of music is his?
I don't know. I mean, that was the thing with the book. I wanted the reader to figure that out. Where before, you're right, I did a soundtrack for Don't Skip Out on Me. I did a soundtrack for Northline. I've written a lot of songs based on characters I've written. But with this one, I didn't want to do that because I wanted the reader to come up with what they thought he sounded like. Because it is so music-based. I wanted that part to be what the reader thought. Mm-hmm. The DeLine's new record has three of them. Mr. Luck and Miss Doom sitting on a curb watching our house burn down. Oh. Nancy and the Pensacola Pimp are the three that I think are on that record, on the new record that comes out next year.
So how have things changed for you with music with now that you get to be in the background and let Amy Boone sing?
Oh, it's heaven. It's heaven. I mean, you know, as I got older, you know, as you get older, you start realizing, like, if I want to make changes, I better make them. You know, I think Richmond Fontaine ran for 23 years. And I love those guys. For a small time band, we had a really lucky run. And we had a lot of adventures and we had some minor success, which for us was, for the kind of songs I write, was pretty lucky. So I just wanted us to end as pals. And we did. And I was really happy the way we ended is, I mean, they're still my favorite people in the world. And so I could tell, I always equated Fontaine to like an old van. And I could tell like the wheels were starting to get rattly. Everybody was getting tired. It was asking a lot of everybody to get in the van. I just didn't want the van to explode. I wanted us to pull over at, like, in the old days, we used to go to the space room. And I just kind of wanted us to pull over at a place like that and say, you know, that's where we wanted to end. I mean, we used to do month-long tours and then not go home and just pull into the space room and just stay there for
really
8-9 hours. Yeah. Yeah. We were just pals. We were pals, like really kind of hell-raising pals. And so when we ended that and I started the lines was like heaven. Cause you know, my favorite singers are women singers. I love Amy Boone's voice. I mean, she's as funny and cool as a person could be. And then I got to write, it was like getting handcuffs off. I got to write songs for this person that I didn't want to let down. And I wanted to write her big, sad, romantic ballads that, you know, like a romantic ballad that has a knife stuck in it. So I wanted it different. And she was game for it. And it's a really, I mean, I couldn't ask for a cooler band. I mean, Corey Gray on keyboards and trumpet is a genius. And Freddie Trujillo is like the coolest bass player of all time for me. And Sean Oldham, the drummer of Fontaine, you know, runs the band and he's like, you know, the smartest, best player around, man. He's just great. So it's lucky. It's lucky. And then I hide in the back, man.
That's what I was wondering about, is hiding in the back make writing so much easier because you don't have to worry about singing anything.
I like hiding in the back because no one knows you're there, you know? And like everyone, after the gig, everyone wants to meet Amy and you're like, that's cool with me. I'm like, so I like that. I like it. And but most of all, I love hearing her sing, and I love, you know, I just turn her up in my monitor as loud as it can handle. So it was a lucky break getting that band. It was a lucky break that people have liked us enough to keep going. So yeah, that was a lucky break for me.
Yeah.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. If you're just tuning in, our guest today is Willie Vlotten, author of 7 novels, including his latest, The Horse.
Well, and even with Horse, it has kind of a sweet ending. It isn't like a bleak ending.
I mean, I wouldn't do in an old musician, that's for sure. You know, I mean, I won't give it away, but
yeah, I was gonna say
maybe I just did, but no, I couldn't do it in an old musician. I had to give, you know, I wouldn't do that to, you know, I've been pretty mean to a lot of characters, but
you are pretty mean, but I think there's something about like you getting to just listen to Amy's voice, and you know, you find your own next place, and you know, I think we end up rooting for Al and hoping he'll find his next place. And so,
I mean, the thing with him is he's a tough guy and he's a cool guy and he's no dummy. He's just wounded, you know? And I think he made a dramatic choice to like isolate himself at a time when he should have, you know, not isolate himself. I mean, alcohol in middle age is a tricky, like if you're a hard drinker in your 50s, that's I always say the same thing, but it's true. It is like you're playing with a poisonous snake, and it's not if it's going to bite you, it's just when and how bad. And so I think every guy that drinks hard or, you know, is in their 20s and 30s and 40s, you kind of have to navigate it and figure it out. And as you get older, because you just can't drink good, your body doesn't like it. You have to figure that out. And I think he figures it out by isolating himself. And it was a bad move for him. And he kind of pays the price for it when you meet him. I mean, he's living pretty hard when we meet him, but he gets lucky, you know, he gets lucky. As a musician should get lucky once in a while.
Well, I think that's what's one of the beautiful things about the book is he gets lucky by, you said it's a simple idea, but it's still, he gets lucky by finding something in worse shape than him. And that can give him a reason to get activated, that can give him a reason to get out of there and do something. And I think in some ways, you know, managing heartbreak is what it seems like the book is kind of about, is can you manage it are you going to drink your way down into the grave from it? And it seems like that's what, to me, what Al's messing with.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of years, it saved his life. I mean, booze has saved a lot of people's lives that have severe anxiety.
Yeah, held them together. Yeah.
Yeah. People that live in panic. I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's not, you know, it's not a, you know, it's duct tape at best, and a duct tape that gets mean and changes. But I mean, it does help a lot of people in a wicked sort of way get by. Yeah. It does pay, you know, you pay the price for it. You know, it asks twice. You know, but you don't really realize that until you get older. But I think Al, again, I think he's a pretty beat up guy, but he's no dummy, you know? So in that regard, maybe you're right. He's the least, he's the most kind of, road worn kind of guy that knows the score, I think, than a lot of my characters. A buddy of mine once said that all my characters they always think they're going to hit a big payoff and everything's going to be great.
And I was
like, oh, and I'd never thought of that. And I was like, oh my God, you're right. I mean, and I'm kind of like that myself. And Al's not like that. Al's like, yeah, I mean, maybe it's just the miles underneath him, but I think he's just basically a wiser guy than maybe some of my other guys. He'd be the guy that a lot of my characters in my early books would hang out with him, like his buddies. They'd want his advice on stuff, I think.
And I think the tone of the book, I think that's the answer to it, because it has this really, it's just so melancholy, but it's kind of peaceful in a way. It's got a different feel to it than the last one.
Yeah, I mean, my stuff is always melancholy. I mean, I think with this book, one of the hard things is navigating that with me to make it readable and not too melancholy. I mean, I love melancholy. I love melancholy songs.
Yeah.
But you don't want it to go into bleak, because bleak's tough to keep people reading, and bleak's tough for me to keep reading. Yeah, it's tough. That razor thin thing between bleak and melancholy, you know, I mess with that area too much, and just because that's my blood's that, you know, that's where I live. But it's always a good lesson. Like in editing, I always pull myself back from the bleak to the and disappear into melancholy more, because there's a big difference, I think.
It's more beautiful than depressing. Yeah.
It's nice of you to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't see this as a depressing novel. You know, the thing I always say about my stuff too is like, if you dressed my guy up, any of my characters in a nice suit and gave him a nicer car, people wouldn't say it's depressing. So I think a lot of people stumble at it, that it's more working class, the way it looks and the way it feels. Yeah. And I think they think it's bleak because of that, but I always say, like, you could tell the same story with the guy with the, you know, wearing a polo shirt and have a tennis racket, and you could do the same thing, but people would go, oh, they would, you know, more upper middle class people would feel more comfortable with it, I think.
Yeah. I like what you're saying. Cause like, even in The night always comes, like, she's trying to get this money to get this house. Like, if you just increase the amount or what she's trying to do, you're absolutely right. It is. It's about class. It's about working class dream versus like pie in the sky dream.
Yeah. And I've always been, I mean, as a fan of books, since I was a little kid, I always liked working class stories. I always wanted to write those stories. I mean, I think that was the only thing I knew. I'm good enough at what I do. But the gift, I guess, if I had a gift, it was that I always knew what I wanted to write about. And I always liked working class stories because I always wanted to write stories where people that reminded that w- were like the people that I grew up with, or in the world I understood. Well, why can't they have their own stories? So I knew that. I knew that. And I knew that songwriting as well. I knew that pretty young, that I, what I wanted to write is just not having the ability to do it very well was the got in my way.
I guess I think you're doing fine.
Well, yeah, I'm doing a little better now, you know. Yeah, you wouldn't want to hear my, you know, 13-year-old working class epics, you know.
Well, thank you so much for spending time with me again, Willie.
Well, thank you.
Congratulations again on the beautiful.
Thank you for reading it. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to today's interview with Portland's own Willie Vlotten. Stay tuned to Between the Covers next month when I'll be talking to TJ Klun, author of Somewhere Beyond the Sea. Thanks.
It's the wind blowing in the rain.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening to Between the Covers here on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Original music from Karen Tilui.
Hiding in the clouds, I don't know why. I hear you crying out loud.